you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At his second Red Sea resort stop in 2 days, President Bush made some serious peacemaking waves today when he met in the Jordanian port city of Aqaba with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. On the heels of a summit yesterday with Arab leaders in Egypt, today's summit ended with an Israeli pledge to begin uprooting illegal settlements in the West Bank and a Palestinian call for terrorism against Israel to end. Tonight on Point, Bush, Sharon, and Abbas at Aqaba and a fresh path to Mideast peace. We begin in Doha, Qatar, where President Bush flew today after the Aqaba summit. Maura Reynolds, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, is traveling with the president and was in Aqaba earlier for the talks. I asked her to describe the atmosphere there.
Well, the atmosphere was very hopeful. You could tell that in the way the leaders interacted with each other. It's not to say that there weren't certain tensions, that at various points in their final statements, Prime Minister Sharon looked somewhat impatient or slightly uncomfortable, and there were a few awkward moments with handshakes, for instance. But by and large, there was a sense that they were taking a step that they hadn't taken before and maybe, just maybe, might lead them a place they haven't yet been.
What was the setting for the meetings? We see pictures of the three sitting under a tree for a long time.
The setting was a palace outside of Aqaba, a royal palace belonging to King Abdullah. And at one point in the meetings, Bush invited Sharon and Abbas alone to walk with him out in the garden, and the three of them sat there on the benches under the trees. He probably intended to do this, but it is a similar thing that he did yesterday with Arab leaders, where the heads of state met alone without their staff and without note takers. And in this case, because all three men speak English, also without translators. And a number of us got a rare opportunity to discuss this with the president on the flight from Aqaba to Doha, where I am now. Bush said that the three of them were very comfortable with each other, and that if we could have overheard their remarks, that we would have been surprised at how easy Prime Minister Sharon and Prime Minister Abbas were with each other.
So, Maura, describe for us at the business end of this the major offerings from each of the leaders there today, from Prime Minister Sharon and Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas.
Well, Sharon's gesture has been expected. It's been in the Israeli press for several days, and that is that he pledged to begin dismantling illegal outposts. These are the dozen or so that were constructed after he came into office. And that's considered a positive step, although it doesn't indicate whether Israel is yet prepared to dismantle other settlements that are on the West Bank that are much more populous and much more controversial. For his part, Prime Minister Abbas used very strong language in denouncing terrorism and in promising to disarm Palestinians, all but law enforcement. And he also spoke in a line that President Bush himself highlighted, spoke about the suffering of the Jewish people, expressing sympathy, in effect, for the Jewish people and the nation of Israel, and said that it is time for the suffering to stop. And what the president said is that those are extraordinary statements for a Palestinian leader to express sympathy for the Jewish state and for the Israeli prime minister to pledge to dismantle settlements that many see as the very embodiment of the biblical state of Israel.
President Bush spoke about the importance of an American commitment to Israel's security as a, quote, vibrant Jewish state. Is this a kind of reference to the so-called right of return? Is he saying that a million-plus Palestinians will not be allowed to go back to their historic homes in Israel?
I'm not sure exactly how to read that. What I've been told is that the Israelis, that for them, recognition by Arab states of the essential Jewish character of the state of Israel is a very important thing for them. And while the Arab leaders, both yesterday and Prime Minister Abbas today, are not quite ready to say that, that Bush is saying it is indicating the direction in which he wishes the Arab states to go. So I'm not sure, based on what I've been told, that it's an explicit reference to the right of return. It's more a recognition of the special character of the state of Israel and of the president's hopes that Arab leaders will come to the point where they also accept Israel as a Jewish state.
And more of some more interesting nomenclature coming out today. Bush and Abbas and Sharon all spoke of two states living side by side in peace and security. But Bush and Prime Minister Abbas spoke of Israel and Palestine. I'm hearing that Mr. Sharon did not use the word Palestine.
I would have to go back over the transcript, but the two states living side by side in peace is a formula that Bush has come up with and that has now become a mantra that the others have picked up, and they have signed on to that as a goal. That is significant that they are at least expressing the same goal, whether or not it has the state, you know, the name of Palestine or not.
And what about the president on Air Force One after the meetings? What was his mood, Maura?
Well, he was ebullient is the best word for it. He was clearly relieved that it was over and that he could claim some success. He was fairly modest in his description of what that success was. He described it as progress, as a good beginning. He said he understands that there's much hard work ahead, but he was clearly relieved that the twin summits had come off as well as they had, and he praised actually primarily his staff for laying much of the groundwork, in particular Secretary Powell.
We read President Bush saying the Holy Land must be shared between the state of Palestine and the state of Israel. Did the president present himself as a kind of enforcer? He's using the word must there.
He did a bit. In his interview with us on Air Force One, he said several times that he had told the leaders that he would, in fact, be monitoring their progress, and he used the expression ride herd on them. And then he expressed doubts that that expression could be adequately rendered by translators, but that it was clearly his intent. And his naming of the U.S. coordinating team or monitoring team that will immediately begin work in the region is a clear sign that he is saying that the United States is going to try to shepherd this process through and keep both parties on track as much as we can.
And Maura, finally, is there a sense that President Bush will continue to stay personally involved in this along the lines of President Clinton's involvement, or that he'll now sit back and let the monitoring team take over?
No, it's very clear when you speak to the president that he's very personally involved in this at this point. This is my interpretation, but I think he sees it as a kind of mission. And the fact that previous presidents have failed does not mean that it's not worth trying again. And he's raised the point several times that he believes that conditions have changed since the last failed attempts, and that it is his responsibility as a leader of a very influential state to take up his responsibilities to try to solve this very difficult problem that complicates not just life for Israelis and Palestinians, but also complicates life for many other states and for geopolitical relations around the world.
Well, much more to come, but quite a day in the Middle East. Maura Reynolds, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me earlier from Doha, Qatar. Great hope and change is coming to the Middle East, President Bush said today before the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers shook hands publicly for the first time at a three-way summit in Aqaba. Within hours, Israeli protesters poured by the thousands into the streets of Jerusalem, condemning Sharon's pledge to begin dismantling some settlements. Palestinian militants, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, declared they will not lay down arms, as Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, pledged today as one of his goals. No one said following the roadmap would be easy or that the effort is guaranteed to lead to peace. Far from it. But the Red Sea rendezvous was heralded by Bush and many others today as a significant new step in a bold new initiative. Did you see something new today in Aqaba? Are Israel and the Palestinians ready, equally ready, to move forward for peace? Should they be? And what needs to happen within Israel and the Palestinian Authority to make the roadmap work? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Jerusalem is Dori Gold, advisor to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and foreign policy aide to former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Good evening and welcome, Dori Gold.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us at such a late hour there. Also joining us from Aqaba, Jordan tonight is Michael Tarazi, legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Good evening and welcome, Michael Tarazi.
Good evening.
And thanks to you as well for staying up so late. Michael Tarazi, let me turn to you first. What did you make of the day's events, of the day's statements? Is this a new beginning of some kind?
Well, I certainly believe it is. I mean, we were very encouraged
by the American engagement in the process, which has been missing now for the last 2.5 years. And we saw that that engagement can actually produce results. I mean, Palestinians certainly are not suffering any delusions. We know that Sharon did not want to accept the roadmap. He spent weeks delaying his acceptance of the roadmap and only accepted it kicking and screaming after adding several conditions to it. We know that he didn't want to come to Aqaba. We know he certainly didn't want to make a commitment to a viable and contiguous Palestinian state. But yet he did all that. And so therefore, we are encouraged that American involvement is producing results by pushing Sharon towards peacemaking gestures.
And Dory Gold, let me put it to you. What did you make of Sharon's presence in Aqaba today, of the threesome being there, the statements made by Mahmoud Abbas and President Bush?
I think it was all a very important start, but actually Prime Minister Sharon began articulating an acceptance of a Palestinian state long before the engagement of the Bush administration. This is his strategic view, that it is better for Israel to reach a territorial compromise in the disputed territories of the West Bank. And I think we've been moving this along. We do have certain reservations with how the roadmap might be implemented, but Prime Minister Sharon is going ahead. We're hoping that the Palestinians will begin to implement the security side, because that's what originally killed the Oslo process and brought us into the very difficult situation we're in.
I wonder about the pushback on both sides, Dory Gold. We saw the reports already today in Jerusalem, thousands of protesters out with posters saying no to a Palestinian state. We remember what happened to Yitzhak Rabin when the peace process really got cranked up. Do you see even civil strife resulting in Israel if this whole effort is pushed aggressively forward?
Well, you know, Israel is a democracy, and I think many Israelis are concerned, you know. Are we going into a process where the infrastructure of terrorism that grew in Palestinian cities and areas under Palestinian jurisdiction will be dismantled? That's something I think many Israelis are waiting to hear and see. I believe that if the Palestinians fulfill their security commitments, many of those who are concerned about where this roadmap is going to lead will come to accept of this new process, but it really depends on security. Let me be very specific. Today we had 60 warnings from our intelligence services of separate attacks by different Palestinian groups. Right now, the reason why we don't have a wave of suicide bombings in our cities is because the Israeli army is deployed around those Palestinian towns. We don't want our soldiers there. We want to pull them back, but that is not going to happen unless the Palestinian security services reorganize and totally uproot this vast infrastructure of terrorism in their midst.
And Michael Tarazi, what about Mahmoud Abbas's pledge today to end that terror? We got a response very quickly from a Hamas official saying, "We will never be ready to lay down arms until the liberation of the last centimeter of the land of Palestine is complete." Can the Palestinian Authority, can Mahmoud Abbas bring an end or at least a significant diminution in the violence that has disrupted peace efforts before?
No, absolutely. But first we have to understand that the Palestinians are not the security subcontractors to the Israeli occupation, and it seems as though the Israelis are constantly trying to push us into that role. We have long argued that Israel's lack of security is directly linked to the Palestinian lack of freedom, and there is no way to have peace and occupation at the same time. Israel must make it very clear that it's prepared to end its occupation, that it's prepared to abide by United Nations resolutions, and is prepared to observe international law. And we were very encouraged today when Sharon, in effect, admitted that Israel was violating Palestinian human rights and that he would do something about that.
But here
so
you've
we
got
to understand that both sides do have to act in parallel, which is the term of the roadmap, that both sides must act unconditionally, independently, on their particular behalf.
And but Hamas seems Israel to be saying, parallel be damned, we're going to stay with our project here.
Well, Hamas is not a signatory to the roadmap. It's the Palestinian Authority that is. And this highlights the fundamental difference, is that our extremists are opposition groups, and we can try to control them. But the Israeli extremists are running the government, and who's going to control them? For example, the Israelis in phase one of the roadmap are expected or obliged to freeze all settlement activity, as well as evacuate all settlement outposts that have been created since March 2001. However, Israel didn't take the opportunity of freezing that activity. I mean, that's something they could have done overnight. There's absolutely nothing stopping them from doing that.
Michael Tarazi, stand by. And Dory Gold, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about Bush, Sharon, and Abbas at Aqaba. Israel, Palestine, and a high-stakes push for peace has a new day dawned in Aqaba. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush, Sharon, and Abbas at Aqaba, Israel, what President Bush today called Palestine, and a high-stakes push for peace. You can join the conversation. Has something new begun with today's summit in Aqaba? Were the opening moves dramatic enough, or were they too much? Are Israel and the Palestinians equally ready to move forward? Should they be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, both staying up late to be with us, and we appreciate it. Dory Gold in Jerusalem. He was in Aqaba earlier today. He's an advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And Michael Tarazi, still in Aqaba, Jordan tonight, legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Dory Gold, what do you expect as the first areas of real progress here and the first areas of real friction or difficulty in this new process?
Well, the roadmap is built on a sequence. And, you know, we would have wanted it to be much more clearly sequential, but nonetheless, there are certain words used. With respect to the Palestinian need to fight terrorism, the roadmap speaks about that the Palestinians must immediately, the word immediately is used, to undertake an unconditional cessation of violence according to a variety of security steps. I think this is significant because for us, the most important sign of success will be that the Palestinians take responsibility for the areas under their control. You know, we're not asking the Palestinians to be our subcontractors. What we are asking them to do is to be like the Jordanians and the Egyptians. Neither Jordan nor Egypt will allow terrorist organizations that attack Israel in the areas under their jurisdiction. It might have been that way in the 1950s. It is not that way today.
And what about the...
Sorry, Dory Gold. And so, for us, that step is essential. Now, it's also very important here that we don't have just Abu Mazen blowing the whistle and saying, okay, stop violence today, but actually remove this vast terrorist presence in the areas that he controls. That's also called for in the roadmap. So we're talking about disarming the various groups and actually dismantling those groups.
And Dory Gold, let me ask you about the illegal settlements.
What you're asking about are the is the issue of the settlements, is the issue of the outposts.
Yes.
The outposts will be addressed by Prime Minister Sharon immediately, as they're called for in the roadmap. So we'll address our issues. The Palestinians must address their issues, and they can't link it to political issues. The cessation of violence is unconditional. There is no understanding of root causes contained in the roadmap. We have to just stop violence. There's nothing that possibly can justify sending a young Palestinian with dynamite strapped to his body into a crowded Israeli cafe.
Michael Tarazi, what about the pledges made today, the first steps in this process? Do you believe the parties can deliver? Will there be a cessation of violence? And do you believe the Israelis, will they pull out of the illegal outposts as promised?
Well, there's certainly no magic button that one presses in order to, you know, have a cessation of violence. There's a violence that's happening within the political context of oppression, and therefore you have to address that political context of oppression and occupation. Also, the Israelis were expected, according to the roadmap, to condemn violence against Palestinians. They didn't actually do that today, even though the roadmap specifically says that they should do that. And the reason they didn't do that was because the violence against Palestinians is coming directly from the Israeli government. They would, in effect, be condemning themselves.
But are you saying then that the first
are
you saying then that the very first steps promised today are already too much to hope for?
Not at all, because we Palestinians specifically said, as Abu Mazen said today in his speech, that he would begin implementation immediately. See, he's not taking the Israeli strategy of looking for excuses and therefore saying, well, the other side has to do it first. We're prepared to do it first, and we took the initiative by accepting the roadmap as soon as it was issued, whereas the Israelis, of course, spent days, weeks dragging their feet before they accepted it. And now they're looking for excuses for it to not work. And so we understand that. So we're going to constantly put them under the spotlight. We're going to do what we can immediately, and we're going to continue to do that to make sure that Israel is constantly under pressure to meet us every step of the way, because we know they're constantly looking for excuses. Of course, today they said that they were going to evacuate, immediately dismantle a settlement outpost that had been established since March 2001. However, of course, they put in the word unauthorized settlements. That word is not in the roadmap. This is Israel simply inserting its own definitions. It's giving its own interpretations for how it's going to act by the roadmap, and it's making us very nervous because those words don't exist in the roadmap, and they're certainly going on in their own interpretation.
Michael Tarazi, Dory Gold, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight from Teaneck, New Jersey, Stephen Cohen. He's national scholar for the Israeli Policy Forum. He's been very close to the process of developing the roadmap since its inception last year. Good evening, and welcome, Stephen Cohen.
Good evening, Mr. Ashbrook. And I think that you can see already what was the important role that had to be played by President Bush, because here you have two very distinguished men, one Palestinian and one Israeli, and each of them is very effectively advocating for their side. And you can see the important work that was done by the American team in both developing the roadmap and in also developing this event today to make sure that each side is moving forward. And you can understand why the United States has taken on its very special role of monitoring the performance, that what the United States is saying is that what is going to be unique about this process is that it's not going to be Israelis evaluating whether Palestinians meet their goals and whether Palestinians are going to be evaluating whether Israelis meet their goals, but whether the United States is going to be saying, here are the things that are in the roadmap, here is what we are evaluating is what the Palestinians should be doing and whether they're doing it right, and here is what the Israelis should be doing, and we're evaluating whether they're doing it right.
Stephen Cohen, stand by. Dory Gold, I know I have to let you go in just a moment. Let me put that straight to you. Is Israel ready to have its performance in the roadmap judged by Washington?
Well, the U.S. and Israel are allies, and I don't think we have any problem with U.S. commenting on what we're doing. We've tried to come forward immediately and not look for excuses, but make certain concessions. I can tell you very personally, I was in a bomb attack in 1975 in Zion Square. I saw many people killed. The man who perpetrated that bomb attack was in an Israeli prison, a Palestinian. We let him out. We let out other prisoners in order to create a better environment, a supportive environment. Those are risks we're taking, and there's some that are very unpleasant for us. But we think it's important to create a new environment with the Palestinians and move out of what we've out of the morass we've been up until now.
And Dory Gold, I'm going to let you go in 1 minute, but the roadmap calls for a Palestinian state by 2005. Given the dynamic you saw today at Aqaba, given all the challenges ahead and the U.S. push, can that happen?
Well, there's been this ongoing debate whether the roadmap is performance-based or tied to specific dates. You know, we had dates in the Oslo agreements and nobody met them because the actual requirements of particularly the Palestinian side to fulfill security requirements were not fulfilled, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad just spread through Palestinian cities. What we're going to need is to make sure that we have to make sure that the Palestinians fulfill particularly these security dimensions. Remember, we've lost 1,000 Israelis during the Oslo period from these terrorist attacks. And I know the Palestinians try and say that they were under occupation and they have a right of resistance. Nothing justifies murdering innocent civilians.
Dory Gold, we know I have to let you go, but thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dory Gold is former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations and advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Michael Tarazi, you hear in Stephen Cohen observing from the United States the sense, the expectation that the United States is going to be watching every step of the way and pushing both parties to fulfill their new obligations. Are you confident of that?
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, I certainly agree with Stephen Cohen that this is largely a result of American involvement in the region, that we've been able to push Sharon as far as we've been able to push him, and we hope that involvement remains. The Palestinians have always maintained that the best way to move this forward is to have independent, neutral third parties who can monitor and hopefully enforce the roadmap in any peace initiative. That's what's been missing in the past. We, as a far weaker party, have always asked for that neutral third party to come in to help correct that imbalance of power between a very strong Israel and a very weak Palestinian Authority. Otherwise, if you just leave the two parties together, the stronger party will simply beat up on the weaker party, and we've seen that happen from the Oslo process. So we're quite pleased to see third-party engagement on behalf of the Americans, and we hope that that will continue.
Michael Tarazi, Stephen Cohen, please stand by. We've got a lot of callers here who want to join us. Yitzhak is calling from Linfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Yitzhak. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
I want to make a point, and that is, what is really different today from what happened in Oslo is that we have an empowered U.S. president by the fact that he was fighting terrorism in Iraq. Now, we may not not everybody may look at it that way, but the Israeli perception, or the Israeli common perception, is that the war in Iraq was in fact a war against people who support terrorism. The President of the United States, by coming to Aqaba, is bringing with him the actions that he has taken. He has taken Saddam Hussein out of the formula.
So are you are you optimistic tonight, Yitzhak?
I feel that something drastic has changed. I think that the Israelis that are supporting this move and those who are very skeptical of it are in fact more optimistic about the possibilities, because they see an American president who has been willing to take action against terrorism that Israel have always said it does not matter if it is Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden or it is Yasser Arafat and terrorism coming from Palestinians.
Yitzhak, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Stephen Cohen, how about it? Has the landscape really been changed by the war in Iraq? And what about the other monitor of this process, or monitors, which will be hardliners in Israel and in the Palestinian community who do not have an interest in this going forward?
I think that everybody would agree that the region is in a very different position after what happened on September 11th, after what happened with the Iraq war. The president was wise enough not to ask all the parties to accept the American interpretation of what has changed, but they are all acting with an understanding that the American role is much enhanced and that the American responsibility is much enhanced. Whether they think it's because good things were done in Iraq or whether they don't think good things were done in Iraq, they both understand that now the United States is more deeply involved, and that deeper involvement can, in fact, bring the results that they want. And I think that that's a critical factor that is driving the process. But I must tell you that I think it's not the only factor that's driving the process. I believe that despite all the huffing and puffing of Israelis and Palestinians, both sides realize that the kind of bloody confrontation that has gone on, in which over 2,000 Palestinians have died, in which almost 1,000 Israelis have died of the last 2.5 years, is not something that either society wants to sustain or can sustain, and that it's much easier for both of the leaderships to take these decisions when they are reinforced by the strong presence of the third party. And I think that that's something that President Bush has understood this week, and I think that he's starting to move with it.
You certainly sounded fired up today. Stephen Cohen, Michael Tarazi, I want to welcome to our conversation Tarif Abushi. He's joining us tonight from Houston, Texas. He's an independent writer there and former director of the Houston office of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Good evening and welcome, Tarif Abushi.
Thank you.
Like Stephen Cohen, you were watching Aqaba from the United States today from a Palestinian perspective. What did you make of what you saw and heard?
Well, to me, it was a sense of the more things change, the more they stay the same. Here again, we have a peace process. I'm thinking back to September 1993, the Rose Garden in the White House, the handshake between Rabin and Arafat.
Yeah, who could not think of that today?
And I can't help but feel today that we still haven't learned the lessons of Oslo. We are still engaging in a process where we all know what the parameters of the final picture needs to look like. I think the international community, certainly many in the United States, all over the world, recognize that the two-state solution, and indeed the roadmap itself recognizes that the two-state solution has got to be based on the United Nations Security Council resolutions 242, 338, and 1397.
So are you saying people still aren't ready, from your view, to stand up and do what's necessary?
To stand up and define the destination. We are busy talking about first steps here and whether it's an illegal outpost or an unauthorized outpost. But the reason why Oslo failed is because expectations were set high when, in fact, the two sides had not come to an agreement on what the final situation was going to look like. We just heard that the president has stated that the Holy Land must be shared. Mm-hmm. When you and I talk about sharing something, typically the sharing is the dividing of the pie is going to be somewhere along the lines of 50-50 in order for it to be fair.
Well, it won't be 50-50
It won't be 50-50. The Palestinians long ago accepted, mm-hmm. during the Oslo, at the beginning of the Oslo process, accepted a division that would give them 22% of historic Palestine and give the Israelis 78%. That's the sharing that the Palestinians have signed on to. Israel has always rejected this. It still rejects this.
Michael Tarazi, let me turn to you in Aqaba. We heard today Ariel Sharon talking about a contiguous Palestinian state. Are the expectations within range of one another, of the two sides in this? Or as Tarifa Bushi says, are the starting points so far apart that they won't be bridged?
Well, there isn't really a starting point. I think Mr. Bushi is trying to say that we haven't really talked about where we're ending. Everyone is sort of starting from their own interpretation of where we're going to end, and this is going to come to a rude awakening as we get closer to the big issues. As he points out, the Palestinians are only asking for the 22% of their historic homeland that has been under occupation since 1967, and the Israelis take the approach that, okay, we'll take the 78%, and now we're going to negotiate over the 22%, and you Palestinians simply have to compromise. And I do think it's very important for Ariel Sharon to talk about a contiguous Palestinian state. In many ways, is interpreted by Palestinians as saying, well, gee, if we got the entire West Bank, it would be contiguous. So that means he's actually talking about giving us something less than what we're entitled to. And why then would we go down this road, this roadmap to peace? So, again, I think we do have to remain conscious of the fact that the Israelis are asking for much more than they're actually legally entitled to.
Stephen Cohen, lots of hopeful sounds today and statements, but as soon as we step off the dock, we're right back into these choppy seas. How does this push through, just the kind of objections and fundamental differences in perspective you're hearing right now?
Well, I think that we have to be not like the high school student who thinks that he's learned his math problem by looking for the answer in the back of the book and not learning the process of how to get to the answer. Mm-hmm. I think that the idea of the roadmap is a very careful attempt on the part of this administration, which was itself very reluctant to get involved, to try to find a way to enter into this these troubled waters, knowing that in the end it had to get to the end of the occupation begun in 1967. And I think that the administration is aware of that, but they have to be aware of the fact that there is a complex political process that is going on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side, and they're going to have to move through this process. There are going to be always people, and it's quite understandable, who are going to wonder whether or not we're going to get past the first phase, whether we're going to get past the second phase. And I have very serious questions about that, too.
Stephen Cohen, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. Michael Tarazi, it's very late in Aqaba. We want to let you go, but thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Tarazi is legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. We're talking about Bush, Sharon, and Abbas at Aqaba. Can real new progress be made here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
9-9-2-8-7.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush, Sharon, and Abbas at Aqaba, Jordan today, about Israel, Palestine, and a high-stakes push for peace. You can join the conversation. What needs to happen within Israel, within the Palestinian community, to make this work? Is George Bush the man to get this done? Is Sharon? Is Abbas, Abu Mazen? And how can conditions be created to push past all the obstacles and all the extremism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests at this hour, Stephen Cohen, joining us from Teaneck, New Jersey. He's National Scholar for the Israeli Policy Forum. And Tarif Abuji, joining us from Houston, where he's former director of the Houston Office of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Right now we're joined also by Neil from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. For about a year now, I've been talking about the convergence of forces that will force the sides to compromise. I'm convinced we now have the winning team between Bush, Sharon, and Abu Mazen.
How so?
Well, the convergence is a consolidation of USA power. The recent Mideast Arabic countries now beholden to the USA. Both sides are worn down. These are things that have been stated. But I think the most powerful things are two additional things. One is the need for the Palestinians to come to the table, not humbled, to come as even equal members of the discussion. And I think that Bush's even-handedness in his mannerisms is much more important than any technical even-handedness on the details. I don't think the details is the issue. Pride and honor is the issue, and Bush, I applaud him. I'm not a Bush supporter, but I applaud him in his dealings this way. The other major thing that Shibli Talhami was on the connection a while ago, talking about democracy in the Mideast.
On Point last night.
And he was also, but he didn't talk about democracy in the Mideast last night. He did a couple of months ago on the connection. And what I said then is I felt that the Palestinian public is going to lead the democracy in the Arab Mideast. This is a manifestation of that, and it's very similar to how the Israeli public, in spite of polls and leaders and governments, the public will say how things are going to go.
You're talking about Palestinian democracy, but Mahmoud Abbas is an appointed prime minister.
I understand, but he is a manifestation of the strength of the Palestinian public.
I thought he was a manifestation of the strength of American pressure and insistence on an alternative to Arafat.
I don't think it would help if the Palestinian public did not, as a group, support where he's going. It couldn't possibly happen.
Both good points, Neil. Thanks for making them. Tarif Abuji, let me put the second to you there on the depth of support for Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, as he steps into this very tough process. Does he have enough backing from Palestinians to begin to pull this off?
Excellent points by Neil, and the answer is no. At this point, he doesn't have the backing. But I'll tell you what can give him the backing. Israel's unconditional acceptance of this roadmap is crucial. We don't have it yet. We heard Dory Gold talk about we will immediately begin dismantling settlement outposts. And, of course, Sharon today called them unauthorized, not illegal. But phase one of the roadmap requires, it says, consistent with the Mitchell report, the government of Israel freezes all settlement activity, including natural growth of settlements. Mr. Gold's position was that it doesn't say immediately. But I think what would behoove the Israeli government is to at least accept this explicitly in principle, at least declare, okay, we won't do it immediately, but we do accept in principle freezing settlement activity. We've never heard that.
And we did not hear it today. So
we did not hear it today. In fact, one of the things I noted about Sharon's speech, the word settlements never came up. Now, there is no way in the world that Abu Mazen can go and begin to disarm the Palestinian militants absent a statement of at least acceptance in principle by the Israeli government that they will freeze the settlement activity. But, of course, if they were to do that, in my opinion, the government would collapse.
And then yet another point, when as soon as we step forward, we meet up with trouble. Stephen Cohen, let me ask you about this issue of the right of return. Palestinians continue to raise this, the right of Palestinians who left Israel to go back to their homes there. President Bush used language today talking about a vibrant Jewish state that has been interpreted in some quarters to mean that he is not prepared to step up for the right of return. Is that a real demand in your mind by Palestinians? Is it a bargaining chip? Could it ever happen?
Well, I think that the notion of the right of return has two different elements for the Palestinians. There's an element of it which I think is going to be continually important, and that is that the Palestinians are going to be asking and insisting that the Israelis acknowledge what really happened to the Palestinians in the period from 1947 to 1949.
And what are you referring to?
That the fact that Palestinian society was decimated by what happened in the creation of Israel and in the war that followed, and that is a fundamental part of Palestinian self-image and identity, that is going to be there. Now, what is going to happen with the refugees and their descendants is a separate issue. That's an issue, a humanitarian issue and a political issue, that I believe is going to be resolved not by a massive repatriation move, but rather by their becoming citizens of the new Palestinian state.
So you're suggesting a kind of change in attitude, in rhetoric, in outlook might be enough. Tariq Abushi, what do you say to that? Is it a literal demand for the right of return, or would a new Israeli face and citizenship in a new Palestinian state, do you think, be enough?
You know, it's easy for me. My origins are in the West Bank, and if a state based on the 1967 borders were to emerge, I could go back home. I see the right of return as, first of all, on an absolute basis, it is something that is enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. If we are to say that for practical reasons, the right of return cannot apply to the Palestinian refugees, I would say, well, let's go ahead and change the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Don't you come to me and say you Palestinians are going to be an exception. It applies to the Kosovars, it applies to other people elsewhere, but it doesn't apply to you.
On a
practical level,
yes.
Clearly, the Palestinians cannot insist on the right of return and meet the Israeli need for Israel to be not a democracy, but a Jewish democracy. So something's got to give, and I think that Stephen had it right. What I would add to what he said about the acknowledgement, it's not just an acknowledgement that Palestinian society was decimated. One of the myths that Israelis grow up with is that the Palestinians just up and left. That is an insult to the Palestinians. We didn't just up and leave. They were driven out. Some of them were driven out. There were massacres that occurred at the hands of the grandfathers of the Likud party, people like Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir.
There's no doubt
Israeli historians have documented this.
Tariq Abushi, our time is running down. I want to raise another point here. Stephen Cohen, today in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, we already see a headline, Sharon in mortal danger, that just in taking the steps that he has in the past few weeks and today, Ariel Sharon may already be at physical risk from opponents in Israel opposed to stepping onto this path. How do you assess that risk, and how can we have a positive conversation if that kind of danger is perceived to be there already in Israel before any steps are really taken?
I believe that Ariel Sharon's problem is not physical courage. I think he's a very physically courageous person, and I don't believe that he is thinking at all about the question of whether an Israeli is going to go after him. I doubt it very greatly. I think that the issue for Sharon is that he is taking upon himself a major historical responsibility to turn the direction of the Likud and of the part of the labor movement which he was once part of, and turning it completely around and saying that Israel's strategic interest is served by a Palestinian state, which he did today, is a very important change of direction. I noticed that it was difficult even for Dory Gold to express agreement with that. He said it was Sharon's strategic position.
So everybody leaning forward today. We're out of time, but we appreciate both of you being with us, describing President Bush leaning forward, Ariel Sharon leaning forward, and certainly Mahmoud Abbas leaning forward. Stephen Cohen, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Cohen is national scholar for the Israeli Policy Forum. He's been very close to the process of developing the roadmap since its inception last year. And Tariq Abushi in Houston, Texas, thank you for being with us tonight.
Always a pleasure.
Tariq Abushi is former director of the Houston office of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a plan to bring peace to the Middle East by creating jobs. This is On Point. With key leaders meeting this week in the Middle East, many hope for a lasting solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but find themselves fretting too much and doing too little. With unemployment in Israel and the Palestinian territories sky high, Boston attorney Jeffrey Lewis and his partners want to turn desperate residents into stakeholders for peace by giving them jobs. He found a model in Northern Ireland. An innovative job program there employs residents on both sides of the entrenched conflict in the booming customer service call center industry. In this radio diary, Jeffrey Lewis talks about his plans to bring the call center model to the Middle East, and he hopes build a foundation for sustaining peace for Israel and the Palestinians.
We are trying to draw on the experience of Northern Ireland, which in a similar quest for peace knew that jobs were critically important and found that contact centers or call centers were the fastest and easiest way to create a meaningful number of jobs in the most troubled areas. And we are taking on a humble but we believe meaningful effort to bring economic development and job creation to the Middle East in three different regions, in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, and in Jordan. It's interesting how we all got together. Quite frankly, it happened through chance conversations that I had with the Consul General of Ireland to New England, a woman named Orla O'Hanrahan, who had her post here in Boston several years ago. She, her daughter, and my daughter were friends at school, and we would talk often about the Middle East peace process and the peace process in Northern Ireland and the similarities and differences. And she would tell me about this man named John Cullinane, who had been involved in job creation and economic development in Northern Ireland. And I guess at the same time, John Cullinane was talking to her about how what they had learned in Northern Ireland might be applicable to the Middle East. And she finally said, I shouldn't be in the middle of this conversation. You two should talk to each other. And we did. And Dan Singer, who has a tremendous amount of contacts both in the region and here in the Jewish and Arab communities, and who has been involved in a lot of economic development projects over the years, both in Europe and the Middle East, was also a part of our initial team. We started our project almost 2 years ago because we knew that there would be a time, we hoped that there would be a time when the Middle East would be at peace. And we knew that one of the ways to maintain that peace is for people to have jobs, to have a future, to have something that they can look forward to and to feel that if there is conflict, they'll be losing something. On a day like today, one can't help but be hopeful. I think we have to be realistic. This is a long process we're entering into, and one can only hope that the United States will continue this process and work hard to maintain the process. So, too, we think that the call centers are an opportunity at this time, but we thought they were an opportunity 2 years ago because we believe that ultimately working hand in hand with economic development and job creation, peace and the political forces at work, peace can be achieved. And the way that you maintain the peace is that you make sure that people have something to lose if there isn't peace. And one of the ways in which to do that, of course, is to create a job so that people can move on with their lives. We believe that everybody, really what they want is the same thing that Americans want, which is a job, a place to live, a safe environment for themselves and their children. And we hope that creating jobs can do that. It was an interesting article in a newspaper that I read not too long ago where they interviewed a woman from Northern Ireland who said basically, the political people will handle the political problems. I have a job, I have a future, and I'm going to maintain that job and work toward that future. And I think that shows that when people have jobs and when there is economic development and when there is promise, that peace can not only be achieved, but more importantly, maintained.
Jeffrey Lewis is an attorney in Boston. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor and John Parati. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.